Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. During this hour, here in Studio A, Dr. Charles Jackson joins us. We're going to talk about creation and evolution. You know, a lot of people are trying to breed a hybrid, if you will, between these two views of the origins of life, and especially of man. Can you take evolution, as it is popularly understood, and something of the Genesis account of creation and breed a hybrid between the two that is that does violence neither to evolution in its theory or to the text of Scripture in Genesis chapter 1 and 2? We'll answer that question right off the bat here with Dr. Charles Jackson. Now, this is a good opportunity in this last hour of the program. Any question or any comment on creation and evolution is welcome. You can go as far afield as you'd like to. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're coming to you live this Monday, the 2nd of April. Dr. Charles Jackson is founder of Points of Origins Ministry. He earned a doctorate in science education from the University of Virginia, and he's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Missouri Association for Creation meeting at Gateway Christian Church in De Pere. Dr. Charles Jackson, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Can you take evolution as we popularly understand it and creation as the Bible presents it and breed a hybrid of the two that satisfies both sides of that debate, theistic evolution or a old earth creation, something along those lines?
When you try to do that, you end up twisting what evolutionary scientists understand as Darwinian evolution, and you also end up twisting what people who believe in the Bible understand as the explanation of the origin of things in the Bible. So, unequivocally, it's impossible.
So someone says, I'd like to have a view where I can have an old earth, something like six epochs, six eras of time, stretching out into the millions or the billions of years. And I'd still like to have my, quote-unquote now, six-day creation slightly revised.
Well, my answer as a scientist to that is, it doesn't matter at all what anybody likes. You know, in science, our job is not to determine the truth. Our job is to discover it. The Earth started, the universe began, life came on this planet in a certain way at a certain time ago. And it doesn't matter what anybody likes, or it also doesn't matter what anybody thinks. Our job is to try to find out what really did happen. And there really is one truth about the universe and life, regardless of the people who will say there are many truths. That is not science.
Let's talk a bit about how pervasive the theory of evolution is, sometimes not even in an intentional way, but it's everywhere. It's in the pop culture. It's obviously in education. It seems to be the presumed understanding of the origins of life. Even Christians like myself who believe in a literal six-day creation can sometimes find themselves falling into thinking or talking about the world in ways that, if they just reflect for a moment, are really paying credence to evolution. It's difficult to maintain a consistent worldview with a six-day creation.
Sure. Even we creation scientists fall into that because we were trained by evolutionists ourselves. If I refer to the Permian rock layer, sometimes I accidentally refer to it as the Permian period, 250 million years ago, because that's what I've heard chanted to me constantly. Now, you can certainly see how that has become a part of the culture, but the latest Gallup poll just this year found what has similarly been found for the past 20 years is that Americans believe, close to half Americans believe, that evolution is not true and that creation is. It's always 44%, 47%, 48%. But this year was the first time since the Gallup organization started taking the poll that they found 53% of all Americans disbelieve evolution. The evolutionists will tell you that's because evolution education is not being done well or enough. But repeatedly, I run into Bible-believing Christians in church settings who tell me that their kindergartner came home from school with a book that talks about millions and billions of years. The indoctrination begins extremely early. Their failure to convince the public has nothing to do with the lack of time or effort on their part. As a matter of fact, a creation does not get an airing in the public classrooms. Only evolution is allowed in many situations. By law, you can discuss creation in any state of the union, but the local school district may have a policy, or the state may have a policy on how to approach that. But when a teacher tries, or a school district tries, the ACLU swoops in with their lawyers, and their policy is that when they lose a case, they punish the school district who challenged their orthodoxy, and those little school districts can't afford those lawyer bills. They are forced to pay all the lawyer bills.
How do you respond to someone who says, well, and we hear this a lot from the proponents of evolution, you can't coherently teach biology without teaching evolution. How do you respond?
We were once told that we couldn't coherently teach geology unless we use the geosynclinal theory. Now, the reigning theory in geology is continental drift, which I happen to think is true. We were once told that you couldn't coherently teach astronomy unless you taught according to the theory that the Earth was in the center of the solar system and the sun circled the Earth. And now we've changed that. You certainly, it depends on who you're speaking to. That is an opinion. And again, as a scientist and as a advocate of clear thinking and logic, opinions don't make science. Now, science is run on the testing of opinions. We call them hypotheses. There is no way to progress without guessing and assuming and theorizing and hypothesizing and testing. But those things should never be labeled fact or law until we've made all the tests.
One of the biggest obstacles, and I think even Christians have trouble with this, they say, look, I open my Bible to the first couple chapters of Genesis, and I have no problem believing that God can call into existence out of nothing everything that is, and that this account of 6 days is a reliable account of how God made everything in heaven and earth. But I don't know how to answer the questions about, say, the fossil record and those layers and layers and layers of rock wherein we find all of these fossils. It looks to me, and I have no answer for it, like the evolutionist might be closer to the truth. How do we respond to things like simple questions like, where did the fossil layers come from?
Well, you've fallen prey to the urban myth that the fossil record's in favor of evolution. Everybody knows the term missing link, and there's a reason. That's not just the link between humans and monkeys. It's the link between fish and amphibians, reptiles and birds. In dinosaurs, every major category of dinosaurs, the link between bacteria and larger type cells like the one your body is made of is the biggest link after life begins. But the link that's missing, that's the biggest one in evolution of all, is the link from non-living chemicals floating in the ocean to living things, which Louis Pasteur proved was impossible. It's a law in biology that life comes only from life and never from non-life, and it's the Schwann and Schleiden came up with the cell theory that says that cells only come from pre-existing cells. These are laws of science completely ignored and brushed away. Those aren't opinions. These are testable facts.
So the evolutionist, when he says life at its very nascent point was really just a random coming together of amino acids and proteins and everything else that somehow accidentally was alive, he's really asking for you to admit that all of those laws are true in most cases except for that one case, the first cells that came from the primordial soup.
Well, I think instead it's more of a denial that the primordial soup theory is outside the laws of science and goes against them. They will ask you to believe that, yes, random accidents cause these things, but we know the known testable laws of chemical kinetics, biomolecular chemical kinetics, make the origin of life by natural means outside of science. It's a mythology. It's an urban myth, and it takes faith. Now, I don't fault anyone for having faith in a theory, but I do fault them for saying that other opinions are invalid, and they label other people's opinions unscientific when their own, you know, you point your finger at someone, you have three pointing back at you, and they're not looking at that.
So you would object fundamentally to the dichotomy that is so popular today between creation and science? saying that these two are opposed to one another, that creation and science are opposed to one another.
Oh, one of the things I object to very much when I speak on college campuses is when an evolutionist, one of the professors in the audience, asks a question or makes a comment during question and answer period and says something like, well, creationists say this and scientists say that. You can't let them make these kind of slurs on the sly like that. I say, wait, I have 4 college degrees. You know, I am a scientist and I am a creationist. I'll admit that you're a scientist and you're an evolutionist. What's the matter with saying that a creationist is a scientist? The inventor of the MRI machine, Raymond Damadian, is a creationist. Isaac Newton said that all of science is thinking God's thoughts after him. I have people on college campuses, professors, who will say to me that your belief in God is irrational and stifles scientific inquiry. 2 professors I was debating at University of Texas Tyler said that to me, and I made the quote from Isaac Newton. It's just a bigotry.
So it's sciences or popular sciences bigotry against, is it against a religiously held position or is it against creation in particular?
Well, you know, it's not science's position against creation. It's certain scientists. I'm a scientist and I have a position against evolution. So, you see, this is one of the ways, as you were mentioning before, that we are drawn into this brainwashing. You were doing it just now, and you did it twice, mm-hmm. even though you were trying to discuss how strange this is that this kind of thinking could be brainwashed into us. Science isn't against creation or evolution. The word science means knowledge. Science is an industry. It's an enterprise. As long as it's conducted by humans, it will be flawed and it will stumble along its way trying to find the truth. And what we, the only thing we can do is verify or falsify our theories. Science itself, this pure science, is just knowledge. And much of science, Marilyn Vos Savant, the most famous Mensen in the world, has a article in Parade Magazine Weekly called Ask Marilyn. She has the highest IQ on record in the Guinness Book of World Records. She said much of science, far too much, is based on faith and not on data. She was referring to the Big Bang.
Does evolutionary, do scientists who hold the evolutionary viewpoint, do they routinely rule evidence simply out of consideration when they're doing their so-called evolutionary science?
We have to again remember that this science, evolutionary science, as any science, creationary science, is being conducted by human beings who have passions and preconceptions and even agendas. If anybody tells you they're 100% objective, this person you may now label as a liar. Nobody is. I'm not. I interpret all the data that I see through my creationary lens, my creationary paradigm. Evolutionists won't admit that. They'll say they're being objective, but data is ignored or ridiculed or actually destroyed in many cases. Let's watch this new thing. Back in the fall, an infant Australopithecus afarensis fossil was found in Ethiopia, and it's called the Dikika child. That's the Australopithecus afarensis is the Lucy fossil, which so many people have heard about. But we found an infant version of that creature, that species. And I'm predicting that when they finally free the foot of this one and a half foot tall, possibly 3-year-old monkey from the sandstone in which the foot is imprisoned, that they will find a thumb on the foot. Now, I've challenged several evolutionists saying in public, wouldn't this be a good test case between our two theories to see what they find encased in that sandstone, which will soon be revealed? And they back away, and they go, oh, no, well, that just would mean that we have a different ancestor, you see, somebody else, because in that same layer of rock, dated at the same time period, are human, totally human footprints in the Laotil tracks. And who made those if Lucy had monkey feet?
I've seen artist depictions of the Lucy creature with human-looking feet, with toes at the end of an elongated foot rather than than a foot more like a primate or a monkey?
Well, we didn't find the hands or the feet much originally, and so they were free to draw the hands and feet and make little wax statues with hands and feet, completely human, even though Lucy was 3.5 feet tall, had a brain 1/3 the size of ours, and was, you know, had a completely chimp-like hip. They still drew it that way. You don't realize the scale of the adult Lucy is only 3.5 feet tall, weighs 65 pounds. Well, the feet, we finally found two toe bones between the joints, two little bones. You see, between your knuckles and my knuckles, the bone is straight. But on a monkey's hand and foot, which is really a hand at the end of the leg, the bones are arched or curved. That enables them to get a perfectly circular grip on a tree limb or a banana. And they can do this with their right foot. They can hang from a tree by their right foot because they have a thumb on their foot, and it's probably more powerful than their arm. And so Lucy's toe bones were more curved than modern chimp bones are. And we have found the Dikika child's hands, curved finger bones, like a chimp in every way. Now,
so your bet that they're going to find a thumb on that foot once they free it from the limestone is a pretty safe bet.
Well, I think so, because I don't believe it has anything to do with humans. Now, when I was at University of Tennessee, Knoxville, visiting the McClung Museum, they had a Lucy mock-up hung up in a glass case. Of course, they didn't have the original bones, but always in these mock-ups, the white plastic bones are the ones that they found, and the black plastic bones are the filled-in ones. And there's nothing wrong with filling in the absence of data, you must guess. And you guess according to what your theory says ought to be there. But on that plastic model, they had updated it and put the two little foot bones in the right foot. They were curved. Every other bone in the right foot was flat, like a human's, and had a big toe and not a thumb. Not only that, but the two little toe bones that were curved on the right foot are in black on the left foot, and they're flat too. I think that is being in denial.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Jackson, founder of Points of Origins Ministries. He has an earned doctorate in science education from the University of Virginia, and he will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Missouri Association of Creation meeting at Gateway Christian Church in De Pere. What kind of arguments have you heard in favor of evolution? Our email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin, and Issues Etc. is coming to you live this Monday, the 2nd of April. Have you ever been stumped when explaining creationism or trying to defend this viewpoint? I'd like to hear your experience. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's talk about what I sometimes think of as the phenomenon of the new thing, as you called it. Every 10 years or so, there's another fossil, especially with regard to human origins, that is supposed to be the one, that will finally put to rest all debate about the connection between primates and human beings. And every 10 years, it strikes me, it's a different fossil. And the theory seems to migrate around pretty loosely, depending on what they're digging up out of the ground.
Well, the fossils are one way that we can look and see what life was like in the past. DNA studies using statistical analysis is another way. A lot of people have heard about the DNA studies showing, you know, how old, you know, such and such was and how long ago we split from the apes. But they're basing these things on assumptions and then doing statistical workups on them. Not bad. Not bad thing to do. But they're telling people it is an exacting science when it is worse than weather prediction. Sorry, meteorologists, but they have more frustrations with that than we do. The DNA study showed last March that humans and chimps evolved away from each other for about 1 million, maybe 4 million years, and then they started mating with each other again. The DNA study showed these hybridization matings were occurring, and one evolutionist even said, "I admit I find it difficult to believe that an upright walking hominid would actually seek a mate among a knuckle dragging, you know, monkey gait walking little chimp type creature, but it must have happened." They are wedded to these assumptions and statistical analyses as though they are data. Now, interpretations of data is what they really are. Give me facts. Give me data. Give me evidences. Give me fossils. Don't chop them up in little pieces. Don't pretend that the fossils we've actually found have no meaning to the other bones in the fossil species. This sort of thing is what's frustrating to me. I'm in favor of science. Certainly I have preconceived ideas because I believe the creation model is true. And certainly that has religious implications, but so does evolution. Evolution is, as Richard Dawkins, the famous author of The God Delusion and The Blind Watchmaker this year, said that evolution is the greatest engine of atheist ever devised by the mind of man.
Before we go to this break, with only about a minute or so, your thoughts on intelligent design as a challenger to popular evolution?
Well, sure, it's a challenge because intelligent design seeks to show that there is order and complexity far beyond what could happen automatically by itself, and so there must have been a designer. Intelligent design tries to stay away from the idea of who was the designer and how long ago the designs were executed, but it does try to be objective.
Do you think that those who try to paint intelligent design as thinly veiled creationism are off base?
The connection between intelligent design and creation is undeniable because creation theory excludes evolution as being possible. But people in the intelligent design movement, including some of the leaders, some of them believe the Earth is billions of years old. Some of them believe in some limited Darwinian evolution that may have happened in the past. So in the membership, that stereotype is not necessarily valid.
Do you think it's useful to, we were talking before about the classroom situation, do you think it's useful for people to push for the teaching of intelligent design as an alternative alongside the teaching of evolution in the classroom?
Well, it's actually 0% necessary. All teachers are free to teach intelligent design in the classroom if they want. Only New Mexico had a law against it, and that has been overturned. There are states that have certain policies toward it. But there is no law in the books that actually forbids the teaching of creation. The Supreme Court did not outlaw creation in 1987, as is popular mythologized. It never did happen. As a matter of fact, the evolutionists were real upset that it didn't.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Jackson here in Studio A about creation and evolution. We're going to be giving away Ron Rhodes' book called The 10 Things You Should Know About Creation Versus Evolution Debate to listeners with the best questions or comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or send us your email, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Call or email us during this break. It's a good time to call. I know the weather's beautiful, but it's also important to hear from you, your questions, your comments, and to any experiences you've had in debating these things with friends, neighbors, academics. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. When we come back, 25 more minutes in the program, and 25 more minutes talking creation and evolution with Dr. Charles Jackson. So can we take all of the data itself, and fit it into the creation model? We'll answer that question after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. 25 more minutes in our conversation with Dr. Charles Jackson on creation and evolution. Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part by LCMS World Relief, sponsors of a great conference coming up later this month called the LCMS Conference on Mercy. It's April the 30th through May the 2nd at the St. Louis Airport Marriott. Now, you can get more information at our website, issuesetc.org. We will be broadcasting live from the conference, and I think I'm going to be hosting a panel discussion of the speakers there at the conference as well. Issuesetc.org. It's the LCMS Conference on Mercy. Their logo is a heart-shaped logo on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Let's go to the phones and talk with Mark, who calls from his car. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Pastor Wilkin. I had a question for Dr. Jackson regarding is it inconsistent or wrong to arguing from a creation perspective with an evolutionist to argue the age of the Earth, old Earth, as being, that God created a mature Earth that would give the appearance of being perhaps millions of years old?
That's an excellent question, Mark. Thank you very much. What about arguing a Earth with the appearance of age?
Well, I like the word that Mark used was mature. A lot of people say, well, Adam was created as an adult male, which gave him the appearance of age. And so couldn't the Earth have been created with all these layers of rock, with all these bones in it, as though the Earth had gone through a history of billions of years? Adam was not created old. On day 7, he was only a day old. He had no signs of wear and tear, no mileage on him, just like a brand new car. 2008 car would look like a lot of stuff had happened to it, but it would be brand new, like Adam was. The Earth was also brand new, but mature means ready. The Earth would have had to have had soil on it already, couldn't wait millions of years for the rock to wear into soil. God would have had to have made the environment suitable for living things. Trees need soil, plants need soil. So there would have been some things that we might have called age, but are really just readiness or maturity.
Does that also answer the question, like the starlight question? The light from the stars so far distant would obviously take billions upon billions of years to reach us. Did God create the starlight in transit, kind of like creating a river while it's already flowing?
The in-transit theory is one of the possibilities. Certainly God is capable of doing that. But the scripture also says that God stretched out the universe to make it. That's a little bit similar sounding to the Big Bang theory. Now, if God actually created the universe by stretching out space, he stretches out the heavens as a curtain. He stretches out the heavens as a tent upon its pole in which to dwell in. If God did stretch space, according to Einstein, you're also stretching time. And if we're near the center of that stretching, we wouldn't have experienced as much time as the places at the edge of the universe. D. Russell Humphreys, a retired astrophysicist from Sandia National Laboratory, has done the calculations on this and said that while billions of years would have passed at the edge of the known universe, only 4 Earth days would have passed here. And so there would have been time for the light to have gotten here. I'm simplifying the theory a lot because of time, but Humphrey's white hole cosmology seems to answer that question.
Let's see what Dave has to say, calling from his car. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yes, by your own statement, Dr. Jackson, your emphasis is basically towards the youth and the college age, et cetera, as far as who you direct most of your efforts to. I'm curious, what are the, say, top few questions or the top few surprises that you get from the youth and the college age as you do your presentations?
Thank you very much, Dave.
Well, given the nature of the audience, questions like, did Adam and Eve have belly buttons, comes up. Things like, how did dinosaurs fit on the ark? Could Adam and Eve have been chimps? Don't forget, these students are being taught nothing but evolution day in and day out on the campus. I was at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne 2 weeks ago, and a professor stood up and said, well, you don't have an evolutionist here to represent the evolutionist viewpoint. Why didn't you invite an evolutionist? And I said, sir, today on this campus, hundreds of times, students had the evolutionist viewpoint presented with no challenge, with no creationist to answer for it in the room, and all we're doing is an hour today, and you see that as unfair. You see there's a problem there.
Mildred is calling from Arlington Heights, Illinois. Hi, Mildred.
Hi. I have a time question, too, and my time question comes from verse 5 in Genesis 1. I would like to know if the first 4 verses are included in the first day or if they could be considered separate and actually creation going on but not counted as time.
Okay, that's an excellent question, Mildred. Thank you very much. So you get the first 4 verses here. Are they in part of the first day according to that text?
Well, it does say that God said, let there be light. I think everyone agrees that that's right at the beginning. And then right after that, it says that God saw the light and it was good. And in verse 5, it says, and God called the light day and the dark night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. So Genesis 5 actually tells you the first day happened at the, was concluded or wrapped up in verse 5.
So someone who wants to squeeze billions upon billions of years into the first four verses somehow is going to have a hard time doing that with the text of Genesis as we have it.
Surely. The first two chapters of the Bible say it covers a week only. And probably the third chapter, where Adam and Eve eat the fruit, probably only covers a couple more days. And so you got about 3 weeks, maybe, the first three chapters of the Bible. Some of the verses in chapter two only cover a few hours. The next three chapters of the Bible cover 1,700 years until Noah's flood. Now, God seems to have a pretty good sense of order. And when he does these first three chapters, which are in great detail, and chapter two being just day six in instant replay with extra details, I just don't see where he would just leave out 4 billion years between verse 1 and 2. That's not logical. Now, you can say that you believe that's true, and I can't prove it isn't. But just by taking a read with common sense of the Bible, I think you can't say the Bible says that. You can believe it if you want.
Dennis calls from St. John's, Michigan. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Pastor Wilkins. How are you?
Very well.
I've been studying evolution for a long time, and it's my opinion, having been raised up in the hard sciences and chemical engineering, I have never seen any standing evidence for evolution that would support it. And I would advise any Christian that you would be much better off just accepting God's word in faith and believe the Genesis story as it's put forward, a creation of 7 days. I have a lot more evidence for that, and I have much more faith in that than the faith that it takes to believe in evolution. And I would ask the professor if he has any evidence at all, or if he knows of any, that would support the evolution theory. I have never found any.
All right, Dennis, thank you very much, and thanks for listening up there in St. John's, Michigan. Dr. Jackson.
Well, I think that that's true. Most engineers, many, many creation scientists I know are engineers. They're not theoretical scientists. They're practical scientists. I have one friend who's an engineer with a company in Tennessee, and he said, you know, all those research and development guys, they dream up all this stuff. It's my job to make sure it works without killing anybody. So engineers are usually only interested in things that work. Many engineers are among the creationists are there. Medical doctors, dentists, people who see life, veterinarians, see the miracle of life operating constantly. Now, I'm not talking about armchair scientists who sit in an ivory tower office and teach college classes, and they think, you know, their doctors of philosophy make them purloiners of the great truths. I mean, we're talking about people who see what works and what doesn't. So I can appreciate someone who says they're an engineer and says they don't see any proof for evolution.
Chuck is on the line calling from his car. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how you doing, Todd?
Very well.
Here's my question. Albert Einstein gave us the theory of relativity, explaining the relationship between energy and matter, and energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. So if one were to take the Bible statement that God spoke light into existence, let there be light, and interpret that as meaning let there be energy, can you, from the Bible, deduce then that God created energy on the first day and then, using the theory of relativity, began to create matter out of that energy in the subsequent 24-hour days?
Well, thank you very much, Chuck. It's a good question. So if Einstein says that energy and matter are essentially interchangeable, what do you think of Chuck's reading there?
Well, you can make the assumption that the light was just energy. Light is a form of energy, and not that light that was created at first might not have been all the light that we can see, the visible light. After all, microwaves are made of the same thing as light, radar waves, gamma rays. Perhaps it was a different kind of spectrum of light, but it would have been light energy. Certainly, and there are many creationist scientists who are working on this theory that perhaps the sound waves from God speaking actually is able to snap matter into existence. Hey, that doesn't sound any worse than a quantum fluctuation created the whole universe. That's another mythology that can't be proved. And I could call God calling things into existence by his voice a mythology if I wanted to, except that I believe that's how it happened, merely because I can't prove it. I can look at things, I can make inferences, like the gentleman said, But proving it and God making everything, if God has all power, then he has an ultimate infinite source of energy. Certainly energy could be converted into matter, all the matter of the universe, in a blink of an eye. The mystery is why he took 6 days.
Why he took as long as he did, you're saying?
Yeah.
We're talking about creation and evolution. Dr. Charles Jackson is our guest, founder of Points of Origin Ministries. He has an earned doctorate in science education from the University of Virginia. He's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30, by the way, at the Missouri Association for Creation meeting at Gateway Christian Church in De Pere. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. About 15 minutes left in our conversation. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Matt is calling from Richmond Heights. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Todd. A very, very interesting guest and very well spoken. Dr. Jackson, I discussed this. I'm a young earth creationist, a biblical creationist, such as yourself, with many others, and they want to insist on two areas that seem to compromise somewhat with evolution. One of them is natural selection, that it does in fact occur, and the other, microevolution, and I wondered what you had to say about both of those.
Thank you very much, Matt. Two good questions.
Well, the word selection means to pick, and survival of the fittest certainly is true. The fit are picked to survive just by nature, and so natural selection is a fact. It's something we all agree on. Now, the idea that mutations can occur and then natural selection can select the good ones would only work if there are good mutations in the first place. So natural selection is certainly true. Microevolution is a misnomer. We should call it microvariation because the word evolution implies the whole enchilada from worms to fish to rats to monkeys to people. And if you call it microevolution, it sounds like it's just a little piece of evolution. It's not that kind of evolution. The word evolution just means change. So why don't we call it microvariation? Every example of microvariation that we have ever seen and that all the evolutionists bring up as proof of evolution could also be accomplished very clearly by only rearranging the genes and chromosomes that are present already. You see, you have to have macroevolution to get from worms to people. You have to have new genes with new information making new traits, and there is no documented case of that.
So the fact that a colony of bacteria can very quickly become resistant to antibiotics because the ones that are resistant live to continue to divide is no surprise.
They were already there. They were selected for survival. The rest died. Bacteria can reproduce every 20 minutes in a warm environment full of nutrients like your bloodstream. After 8 hours, you have 1 million of them. All you need is one that can survive. And it doesn't even have to be in that same species. If a bacteria already has the gene or the genetic ability to resist the antibiotic, it can give it to other bacteria of different species. So it doesn't just mean one Streptococcus aureus. One bacteria in the whole world can give it to all the other species of bacteria through transferring genes to one another called plasmids.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Jackson about creation and evolution. 10 minutes left in our conversation. Can we take the data that we have in the fossil record, in dating techniques, wherever else we're going to look for these things, the arguments being made about intelligent design for irreducible complexity, things like this, can we take them and honestly say they all accord with the Genesis 1-2 creation model?
Any model, creation or evolution, is going to have some rough spots that look bad until more data comes in. And the more data that comes in, the more and more the theory ought to look better and better. There's always missing pieces. We don't have explanations in creation theory for all of the data that's there. We don't have any data that excludes creation. Now, evolutionists don't have an explanation for all the data that's there, but I'll tell you one thing that's happening. The more data that rolls in, the worse it gets for evolution, and the better it gets for creation.
What are some of those rough spots? Would you name one or two rough spots in the data for the creation model? We're waiting for additional information.
We've already mentioned the missing links. We've also mentioned the the insinuation based on evolutionary assumptions of mitochondrial clocks and things like the molecular clocks in DNA that humans and chimps hybridized in the past. And that spawned many evolutionists to think that hybridization was the cool way that evolution can get over the fact that there's no known mechanism for evolution to actually move forward. Of course, many hybrids are sterile. Well, that stops your evolution story right there, doesn't it? But they're saying hybridization maybe is the way. The biggest thing that's in the way for the evolutionists is raw data. That pesky data gets in the way every time. Stars that are old, that are in a young gas cloud, according to their ways of interpreting these things. We found in March 2005 a T-Rex bone with a vein in it. Now, this was not a petrified or fossilized. It was the soft vein material, and it had red blood cells in the vein. How could this last? These things are made out of proteins. How could this last 68 million years or 80 million years for the hadrosaur bone they found had real bone cells left in it when we know, all organic chemists know, by the laws of chemical kinetics, proteins can only last 10,000, 40,000 years tops. This is 2,000 times, not 2,000 years longer, 2,000 times longer than that vein should have been able to exist. Hey, but maybe 4,355 years ago, that T-Rex was killed during Noah's flood, and that vein, although rare, those kinds of things may actually be able to be preserved.
Do the evolutionists have any explanation for finding preserved soft tissues in dinosaur bones that they say cannot be there?
Oh, Cameron Chuzita of Case Western Reserve University said at the time, well, the state of preservation of the new specimens is improbable, but obviously not impossible.
So in other words, since we're finding them, that must be possible.
It must be possible, but they figure it must be still 68 million years. In spite of the laws of science that say it can't be true, they are still clinging to their theory that those bones are 68 million years old, in spite of the data. It's this called inertial thinking. Inertia is the resistance to change or in motion or direction. And I think that evolutionists, and anyone who is, you know, wedded to a theory, a cherished theory, has inertial thinking. If creation was not true, it would take not just one data point, but it'd take a number of things to finally disenchant me with creation as the Bible says it, describes it, because I have a little bit of inertial thinking too, but I think I'm a little more open-minded. After all, I was trained by evolutionists and I don't believe it.
David of Fort Worth, Texas asks, he says, everything that I've read on quantum physics seems totally illogical. Is quantum physics true at all? How do you think it holds up as a theory for the fabric of the universe?
Well, quantum physics is a theory. I'm not a physicist, but I know that it's extremely theoretical. We do know there are certain quanta of energy that different electrons hold in different energy levels within the atom. But quantum physics itself as a discipline is highly theoretical. The problem, biggest problem with quantum physics is that the mathematics of it become geometrically expanded into more and more complex and theoretical scenarios. That's usually the sign that we're barking up the wrong tree, because Occam's razor says that the simplest explanations actually turn out usually to be the ones that end up right. Albert Einstein said, keep everything as simple as possible, but no simpler than that.
On quantum physics, I heard some physicists saying, look, we have a hard time explaining it. And one of them was honest enough to say, if I can't explain something, then I don't really understand it. Is that a good barometer of where quantum physics is right now as a theory?
Well, as a teacher, I'd certainly agree with that. I think when you learn something well enough to teach it, you learn it better than you'll ever thought you could have learned it. But, you know, quantum physics may actually be true. Nobody really knows a lot of these things. There are plenty of mysteries, and that's what I love about science. It's what I was born loving about science, practically, is the mystery involved, and learning and discovering things, and, like I said, discovering the truth, not trying to prove what it is. I get one question I do get from college students is, what was the deal with Pluto? You know, and I tell them, you know what? Pluto doesn't care that we changed its designation from a planet to a planetoid. It's still going to just go orbiting the sun just the way it always has. The universe doesn't care what we think about it. You know, we act as though people arguing on a park bench about creation and evolution, that the entire nature of the known universe and the living world rolls back and forth with the tide of who's winning that argument. You know, the universe just doesn't care. The universe is the way it is, and it got this way, a certain time ago, and our only job, our only quest should be to discover what happened, not to prove that our cherished theories are true.
Dr. Charles Jackson is founder of Points of Origin Ministries. He earned his doctorate in science education from the University of Virginia. He's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Missouri Association for Creation meeting at Gateway Christian Church in DePere. Everyone is invited to Dr. Jackson's lecture. It's open to the public. Thank you very much for being our guest. I appreciate your time and coming
in. You're welcome.
Okay, we've got some books to give away, as promised. Ron Rhodes' books, 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate. John in Michigan, who called us earlier, and Dave here locally, who called us as well. If you would give us a call back, we'd be happy, and give us your information, we would be happy to send you that book by Dr. Ron Rhodes, The 10 Things You Need to Know About the Creation versus Evolution Debate. Thank you very much to all our callers. There are many things that puzzle us. That's good, because when God spoke everything into existence and at the end of 7 days had completed his creative work so that he would rest, when he did this, he did not make a universe. He made no promises that this universe that he had made for us would be readily accessible in all of its aspects to our frail human minds. But when he set Adam and Eve into that garden as the masters of creation, not the originators of creation, but the masters of creation, to tend the garden, to have dominion over everything that God had made for them, he did give them the freedom to explore it. I think it's safe to say that Adam and Eve, before the fall, understood completely what God had done. That there were, at least from our perspective, no mysteries for them about how it all came to be. It was all remarkably simple. We manage to make things very, very complicated. Too complicated. After their fall into sin, I imagine that doubts began to arise in their minds. Maybe even Adam and Eve, who had been witness to the creation themselves on the sixth day, who had at one time before their fall walked and talked and communed with God in perfect harmony there in the Garden of Eden, who could remember the garden and their tragic fall, maybe they even began to doubt where it all came from. But that is essentially what you're dealing with when you open the first two chapters of the book of Genesis. What you're dealing with here is doubt or faith. Doubt or faith. A God who can speak all things into existence by the power of his word. It's pretty amazing, right? More amazing? That he would redeem this fallen creation, Adam and Eve and all their descendants, by entering into it in human flesh in the person of his son to suffer and to die. There's the true and amazing mystery. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about liberation theology with Ron Rhodes and the theology of the cross with Dr. Stephen Hine. Tune in tonight at 7 for the rebroadcast of part one of our series on the theology of the cross here on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.